everybody, and thank you for coming along to the International History and my panel that we've got here tonight. I'm Izzy Darlington, and I'm one of the careers consultants at LSE Careers, and I work quite closely with Matthew on the International History course, and I also work quite closely with various others on Economic History, because I know we've got some people who have come over from the Economic History Department today as well, so I'm really glad to be able to host this panel here tonight. The reason Matthew and I wanted to hold something was because we both speak to you about various different careers, and we've both had different careers ourselves, but I definitely believe speaking to people who are actually in the roles and have either fairly recently or see people come through the process on a regular basis can really help you to start to decide if this is the option for you, or you can start to get hints and tips about various different careers. So this is why we've got these people here to talk to you today. Some are LSE alumni, some are history alumni, some are neither. But they're a good mixture, and we'll hopefully be able to speak to you from a range of different backgrounds. So I would like to introduce our panellists from my left to right. So we've actually got Sophie Marmont here from the Civil Service, who will be speaking to you and telling you a little bit more. We've got Alexandra Wood, who is here from Clyde & Co and is a recent trainee at the company. I think it started in September, if that's right. So very recent, we'll be able to talk through the process getting into that section. Probably quite a few graduate schemes in that way. We have Rosamund Irwin, who's here from a journalist background and writes commonly in the Evening Standard, is where I've seen her, and various others, but she'll be talking to you about that. And we've also got David Russell here from the charity and development side of things, and he's had a variety of different roles within that, but now works with SURF, if I believe that's correct. So a range of speakers here, and what I quite like about this range, and hopefully you will be able to see this today, is that I think you do have some distinct different career options, obviously, but ways of which you tackle your approach to getting into these careers, I think, will be quite different. So I think about that as we're going through from the very structured graduate application routes, where you know you've got to do an application form, followed by numerical tests, followed by verbal reasoning, followed by assessment centre, followed by hopefully an offer, through to you know, more of a journalist type development or international development role, where it's more about gaining experience, writing articles, pushing yourself forward so editors want to publish some of your work, chasing, following up, working for an NGO before possibly maybe getting that dream job of yours, which might be at the end of a 2-3 year wait. So without further ado, I will let Sophie take it away and explain a little bit about herself, and then we'll open it up to questions. Thanks very much.
Hi, so I'm Sophie Marmon. I graduated from LSE in 2010. I did history and loved it. I don't want to talk too much because I think it'd be really good to have plenty of time for questions. But what I am going to quickly run through is my career thus far, some sort of hints about the kind of skills that are needed for a job in the civil service, and then a little bit of advice sort of from a personal perspective. So I'll just kind of run through what I've done since I left LSE. So I graduated in 2010, and I'll be honest, I wasn't one of those people who, like you, is thinking very hard about their career before graduating. So I finished and pretty much had no idea what I wanted to do. So my previous work experience before I came to LSE was I'd worked for a year in a financial investment firm doing bits and pieces around sort of business analyst roles. I knew I didn't really want to go down that route, but I really loved history, and I'd just done a dissertation, which I absolutely loved doing. So I decided that maybe something along the history lines would be what I was interested in, maybe some form of heritage role. So I started investigating that. I ended up, after quite a long time, getting a role in the National Trust, and that was an unpaid internship, and it was editorial work, So I did that for 6 months, and that was really fun. It was also very challenging. I'm sure other people will have lots to say about unpaid internships, but they are difficult to fund yourself through, but incredibly rewarding. I learned a huge amount from that. I then toyed with my other love, which is theatre. So I went off and produced a play, which was at the Riverside Studios, for a few months. So that was really fun. Again, unfunded. So I had a year while sort of gaining experience in various different areas, but at the same time applying for a lot of jobs and not really getting anywhere, which was quite challenging and maybe something that I hadn't really expected having graduated from LSE. I thought, you know, I've got a great degree, I've got good work experience, who wouldn't want to employ me? yes. Well, so that was a bit of a shock, but all good experience. So through all of that process, I was applying for the Civil Service Fast Stream, which for those of you who don't know is quite a structured graduate scheme that the Civil Service run. And at the time that I was applying, it was the only route into the civil service because there was a promotion freeze across the board and also a recruitment freeze. So it was really the only route in. I was lucky enough to get through that process and be offered a job. And I'm more than happy during questions to kind of talk about what that process is for recruitment. Since then, I've joined the Department of Culture, Media and Sport. And I've done a number of roles, largely policy-based. So I worked, my first job when I joined was on the Tote Proceeds project, which was, so the Tote was a government-owned bookmaker, which the department had sold off for a large sum of money. And the deal was that we were going to give half of that money back to the racing industry to fund some of their projects. So my first project was I had £90 million and I had to try and spend it, so that was really good fun. I also worked briefly on local TV policy, which was Jeremy Hunt's sort of policy baby, which actually they just awarded two licenses for local TV stations in one part of the country, so that's very exciting. I'm seeing that come to fruition. I've also worked on reforming arm's length bodies, which are also known as quangos. So if any of you have seen the bonfire of the quangos in the press, that's what I've been doing for the last 9 months at DCMS. And my current role now is working on the spending review, which is essentially looking at what our funding package will be for the year 2015-16. So very much budget based, but it's a really interesting role because it looks across the department's spending areas, and I get to look at sort of every area of the department, which is very exciting. I should probably also mention I worked on the Olympics over the summer, which was a real treat. I worked in the press office, so fielding questions from the media. And it was a great experience, and I'm more than happy to answer some questions about that because I'm sure there'll be lots of interest. I did get to go and see some events, although they were through the public ballot, so no perks for working there. So that's a sort of quick run through what I've done in the civil service so far. I'm now also part-time training as an accountant. And the reason I'm doing that is I decided actually I wanted to go back into education. Having been out of it for a few years, I thought I need to do something. I looked at doing a master's and quite quickly realised it wasn't something I was ready to fund myself. So my work on the Fast Stream, DCMS agreed that they would fund me to do my accountancy training. So I'm doing that. And the reason why I'm doing that is not because I want to be an accountant, but because I feel that policy really can't be made without a sound financial background. That doesn't mean you have to be an accountant to do policy, but it can be a really valuable skill and something that I think will help my career moving up through the civil service, hopefully. been talking for quite a long time.
I know, it's actually, you've got more to say, absolutely.
Yeah, I'll just quickly touch on some of the skills that I think are important in the civil service, and then I'll pass over. I think what I've found that's been applicable from history is the kind of analytical side of things and the ability to build a really good argument. Civil servants have a very strict code. We are meant to be objective and unbiased in the advice that we give to ministers. So we look at the evidence, and no matter what our personal views about a policy are, we have to give them what we think is the objective view of that evidence. And that's something that I think is very transferable from the history skill set. One other thing that I think is also useful is project management, which is a kind of big buzzword at the moment, I think, in every industry. And those skills are things that you can get from education and a degree in terms of things like time management, but also you might get from extracurricular activities. So when I was here, I was very much involved in the Drama Society, and putting on a play is a really good lesson in project management. So definitely when you're putting together applications, look at things that aren't necessarily a traditional kind of place to look for skills, but somewhere that you can find them. That's sort of my advice.
Lovely. Thanks very much, Sophie. That's great. If you want to pass over now to Alexandra.
Hi, I'm Alexandra. And I work at Clyde & Co. I started in September. I did history at AS level, which I'm sure all of you must have done, or similar, to be where you are now. And when I did my A-levels, I didn't actually take on history, but I did English Literature, Classical Civilisation and Biology. I went on to study English Literature for my undergraduate degree, and further to that, I did a Master's in Law as well. And I've recently done the LPC, which you do. It's a practical course before you start working a law firm if you want to be a solicitor. So that's, in a nutshell, my academic background. I did English because I enjoy the subject at A level very much, which I'm sure is very similar to the position you were all in. History you will have done at A level or similar, and you can see the progression quite naturally when it comes to taking on a degree. I very similarly enjoyed English, and I could see the progression onto wanting to study it at degree level. I also thought it would be a good foundation for law because it's very analytical, and you look at the language and detail, etc. When I decided to do law, I chose to do an MA in law rather than the GDL, which you've probably heard about, the Graduate Diploma in Law, which is a one-year conversion. I chose to do a two-year MA in law because I wanted to have a USP, a unique selling point, which was different from all the other non-law undergraduates who were all doing GDLs. And it was very, you know, it's a very competitive industry, and so I thought it would help me to stand out. And in conjunction with that, I wanted to do a degree because I wanted to have a more thorough understanding of the law. I wanted a law degree, and that's what the MA gave me, ultimately, a qualifying law degree. And I also wanted to be able to do optional modules so that I could broaden my knowledge as well. So that was what university was like. When I was at university, I did various things in terms of getting experience in law. I went to the university law fair, which was very useful, and I'm sure you've heard of various law fairs if you've seen them advertised around. They're all over the country. And I also attended various firm events in London and at the university, which was very useful, much like this event tonight, or similar networking type events with drinks, evenings, etc. I also did work experience in a small local firm to give me a sort of comparison between what a larger firm would be and a smaller firm, and did I definitely want to work in a larger firm, etc. And I also did casual work for a solicitor's firm when I had finished my MA on a casual basis, which involved taking barristers and clients to a court, etc., which was also very useful. And when I was at university, I also did other work experience like open days with larger firms and those sorts of things. I basically took every opportunity that I heard about and tried to grab it while I could, and talked to everybody that I could about the industry, about what I needed to do, about what people were looking for, so that I could have a better idea about the different firms, what people were looking for, and when I came to applying, having a better idea of what they wanted me to wanted me to show. So then in terms of my role now, I've started in September, so I'm quite new. My role varies very much on a day-to-day basis. I can be working on all sorts of different cases for different fee earners, and I can be putting together bundles for counsel or clients or trial or a hearing or exhibits for a witness statement. I can be reviewing documents or analysing documents, looking for answers to queries, etc. There are general admin tasks which you get in every job, of course, like emails and those sorts of things. Research, I do quite a sort of research as well, which is very interesting and is very similar to what you'll be used to if you've ever done research academically. It's quite a transferable skill in that way. And I've also done things like looking at billing queries on a practical level, which is very interesting when you're not used to the sort of admin or billing ideas. It's all new. It's really useful. In terms of the highs and lows of what I do at the moment, I think one of the most exciting things is being able to see the work you've done in action. When you've put in the hours and you've seen it, and then you see it all come to fruition in whatever way it may, it's really interesting and very exciting. A little bit nerve-wracking as well, of course. The excitement of finishing a large piece of work or the stage of a litigation process is also very exciting, because you know that you're then moving on and that stage is left behind, but it's a big thrill to see that all that hard work has paid off and that stage is complete. And also working on very highly complex cases is interesting as well, of course. In terms of lows, it can be stressful with deadlines. You have to meet them, you have to get things done, and you have to learn to work quickly sometimes. And it can be very busy, so there are some later finishes. It's not a 9-to-5 job, really. But I think a lot of people are aware of that. But, you know, at the same rate, I don't go home at 2 o'clock in the morning, or 1, or 12, or 11. You know, it's not extreme, but, you know, it's not start at 9, finish at 5 on the dot. And in terms of the key skills which I think you need to be successful in the sort of role that I do, I would say that it's important that you're organised. And I'm sure as students you're very used to being organised in some way or another, whether it's getting your assessments in on time, getting to your lectures, and juggling that with doing your laundry, doing your shopping, having your social activities, whatever that may be. Being good at working under pressure, again, I'm sure as a student you can recognise that if you've ever had to fight to get an essay in for a deadline. Good communication skills are definitely important, and being able to explain what the problem is if there's a problem, and similarly bringing solutions rather than problems to the table. If you know that you can recognise there's a problem, rather than automatically asking the question saying there's a problem, thinking first, well, what would the solution be? Being able to use your initiative, being conscientious, hardworking, precise and careful are also all very important skills, I think. In terms of how important networking has been in my career to date, I would say, in a nutshell, very important. You're able to ask questions, as I said earlier, and get a feel for a firm when you talk to the people who work for the firm, the graduate recruitment team, etc. And you're able to ensure that recruiters can put a face to a name. Recruiters see a lot of applications, and if you are able to then make an impression on a recruiter and say, I am this person, I have got an application, it's coming your way, then they, when they see your name on the application, the hope is they won't just think it's a name on an application, they'll think, oh, I've met that person, oh, I know who that person is, oh, they were really impressive. That's what you hope, anyway. The skills that studying history can give you that are relevant, I mean, there are lots, I think, but one of the most relevant, I think, is that with history, obviously my understanding is only SAS level, so you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong, but you look at the facts from the past and analyse how events have unfolded. And in terms of law, you do a very similar forensic analysis of facts in that way. When you're looking at how things have unfolded, when you look at who spoke to who, what happened, those sorts of analytical skills are very relevant. In terms of the advice that I would give to a history student about to embark on a career search, generally, not just for the law, but I'd think about what you want from a career. Where do you want to work? Do you want to work in London? Do you want to work elsewhere? Do you want to work in an office? Do you want to work outside? Do you want to move around? Do you want to work with people in a team, or would you prefer to work on your own? And are you willing to work hard when you need to? Those sorts of things. So that's about it, I think.
Great. Thank you very much, Alex. That was really, really helpful. And just to point out, Hayley from the HR department is here as well. She's just raised her hand there. So if anyone has more specific questions on actually the recruitment process times, deadlines, which we know in the legal sector are a bit of a confusing matter, please do grab her afterwards. But you raised an interesting point about networking, and I think it'll be interesting as well to hear from Rosamond and hear her career to date and how maybe things have helped her in that way. So,
Rosamond. So I'm a columnist and feature writer for the Evening Standard, and I've actually worked there 5 years now, which makes me feel really old. I also review papers on Sky News, and I work for the BBC occasionally, and I've written for magazines, including The New Statesman, Braxia, Marie Claire, and supposedly I'm writing a book, although my agent would really like to hear something about that sometimes. So I cover all media, but print's my specialism, but you can ask me questions on all of them. When I started at the Standard, I was actually on the business desk, and I was, obviously this is a terrible, terrible thing for the global economy, but I was incredibly lucky because 3 weeks into my job, Northern Rock happened, and I remember my editor came over and he said, "Ros, don't get too excited, it's nothing like this, as, you know, this doesn't normally happen, don't assume this will happen again in the next," and then everything fell apart in the entire world. So it was a very good time to start in business, and actually, it's one of the things... you don't find many people in journalism who... I read PP at Oxford, so I did have an interest in economics, but you'll find there aren't many people in journalism who actually have a business background, and I think it's a very good place to start, because people naturally assume you're smarter than you actually are if you can talk about business. It's a terrible thing about journalism. That's a bit like if you can talk about science or any of these strange things that very few journalists actually know about. About 2 years ago, I got a column on the paper, and that helped me move to features, which was actually what I wanted to do. And I write interviews and longer pieces. And I'm on my way over here, I actually realised that I kind of owe my career to the LSE, because I'm not one of life's planners. When I finished Oxford, I was actually only 20, I was about to turn 21, and I hadn't really done any work experience. I hadn't really got a life plan. And there were these terrifying people, a lot of them who did PBE, who had these sort of five-year plans. A bit like Stalin, really. And I didn't have anything like that. And I sort of bumbled into the world and desperately applied for jobs. And thankfully, it was 2005, and jobs were plentiful if you had Oxford PPE on your CV. So somebody gave me a job, and I was this dreadful job where I was a slave to spreadsheets for 9 months. And I just advised nobody to have as little plan as I did. I think that's the crucial thing. Anyway, after 9 months, which I thought was... the shortest time you could have on your CV without looking really, really bad to employers. Apparently it's actually a year, so I misjudged even that. I came to the LSE to do a Master's in Population and Development. Again, nothing actually useful to journalism. At which point I started writing for this esteemed publication, which I have found on my way over here. And bizarrely, that launched my career. So, God bless the beaver. I think it was probably that when I applied for my job at the Standard, which was actually advertised, again, it was 2007, a glorious time where journalism jobs actually very, very occasionally were advertised. I think they just liked the fact it was called the beaver, and they were going to snigger about that forevermore. So, anyway, I miraculously got a job at the Standard, and obviously it was quite an exciting time to be doing business. What I would say... it is a bloody tough industry to get into. I lucked out, and I think when you hear people, I mean, they obviously they could Google me and they found articles, and for whatever reason they quite liked them. But I would say it is not, particularly now, it is very, very tough. And I think the fact that I when I was here, I did work experience at the Telegraph and the Times, which again I had to beg people to give me. It is so hard even, and I didn't know anyone. There's a lot of nepotism in journalism. I don't have any family background of journalism. I didn't know anyone. There aren't that many people in journalism who would be able to say that, though there are some people. I would say if you really, really want to do it, and print is obviously is struggling. I mean, The Guardian, The Times are chronically loss-making. The Standard has actually turned a profit, but after years of losing money, and that is something that we're obviously very proud of. I think you really, really, really have to know that that is what you want to do. And TV and radio obviously are other options, and I would advise people to look quite strongly at those if they really want to go into media, and obviously new media too. In terms of getting into it and the divisions within it, I started off obviously with a more newsy background, but comment and features are much more what I enjoy. If you're thinking about news, you've got to be someone who I think is this odd mix of patient and impatient, in that you will doggedly chase down a story, but at the same time you will be impatient enough to force people to talk to you. And sometimes a lot of that can be quite wearing and draining. And the other thing I would say on the hours front in journalism, particularly when you're starting out, it's different, I think, when you're an editor. But you have to just be really committed to getting it, even if you're still there at whatever time it is. And I've done interviews where there was one where I sent up to Manchester for a Tory party conference to interview an MP. And I got back to London at 9 p.m. and they wanted the copy for the first thing in the morning. So I pulled a 28-hour day, which is probably illegal. But anyway, so that was 1,400 words on their desk for 5 a.m., which is killer. And, you know, you've got to be the kind of person... I mean, I was so disorganised at university, I was quite used to all-nighters, so I'm really good at them. But if you're not that kind of person, it's probably not the industry for you. There are killer, killer deadlines. And also, you're always... If you are chasing a story, you're always trying to beat other people to it, because there will be somebody else who is after it. And there is nothing more frustrating in the whole world than chasing a story and opening the Times the next day, you know, you didn't have it finished, and there's your story, because you've spent however much time thinking about it or working on it. And obviously it will happen. Our deadlines at the Standard are different from other papers, so we, you know, are occasionally trumped in that way. What I would say about things you can do if you want to go into journalism, I read anything. I read my mum's a doctor, I read her British Medical Journal. You find stories in the weirdest places. Also talk to people, and that sounds like the most simple thing in the world, but everybody you know will know one thing that is a story, at least this is my theory, probably more. They won't know it's a story, and it's your kind of job to work out that it is. And I think the other thing is, everybody's really snotty about certain newspapers. I'm on the left politically, and I suppose I'm supposed to be very snotty about the Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph, therefore. But those are two very, very well put together newspapers that know their editors, that know their readers incredibly well, probably the best of all papers, along with The Sun. And I may not agree with their stances, but they have very, very good journalists. And I think what people tend to do is they read a paper that confirms their prejudices. And if you're a journalist, you probably need to do the opposite. So you need to be reading a paper regularly, and if you want to be a journalist, that is challenging your views or is putting the world in a different way. I think that's probably a really useful thing we should all do anyway. But most people, if they're left-leaning, will pick up The Guardian and nod along, or they will, if they're right-leaning, they will nod along to The Telegraph, whatever it is. And I suppose that's probably quite a lot of things that I've said there. Networking, I mean, I hate it. I'm sure it's really, really desperately important. Line is always, though, far better on an evening to go out and find one person that you like and would actually ring up in the morning and talk to, rather than those ghastly people who are constantly looking over your shoulders at parties, of which there are many in journalism, and who aren't really listening to you. And I mean, frankly, I find networking quite revolting. So what I would say, and this might be terrible advice, But my approach is go out and make a friend. Like, we can never have enough friends. And they will tell you something eventually. Don't go out and chase people who you probably really can't bear to have a conversation with. Because it's just a miserable way to live life as well. So that's probably everything. But ask me any questions except about Leveson. I'm rather sick of talking about it.
Thanks, Rosamund. That's really, really helpful. And I think you've made some really interesting points. A lot of what I do in the careers team is trying to dispel myths about networking, that it doesn't have to be horrible cheese, wine in hand, and trying to actually just reaching out to people, and you know, is an interesting way to find helpful advice. And as you say, one person that you know can generally in an industry or have a story that can help you in some way. So that's really helpful. Thanks very much, David. I'll let you, last but not least, thank you.
So, yeah, I'm probably a little older than my fellow panellists. So I graduated from Cambridge, did SPS in 1999. And, yeah, had little or no idea of what I wanted to do. I just felt that I wanted to do something meaningful that I would enjoy, which evidently I thought was a charitable job. And, went to seek the advice of a good friend's father, and he said, you know, if you really want to go into charity, the best thing that you can do is go work in business first. Then you'll have something really sort of tangible to offer to a charity. And he goes, you know, you could wait for the perfect charitable sort of job in charity to come along, and it may never come. And, you know, if I were you, and this is what I did, or he did, just take the first job that is offered to you, and the worst that you'll find out is that you don't enjoy it, and you'll move on to find another job. And I think that actually was pretty sound advice, because I think, you know, certainly, you know, I've been working now for 14 years. Nothing I have done has been planned. I think if you just open yourself to opportunities, opportunities do come around, but I think you've got to be, you've got to be willing to put yourself out there in order to generate different paths that can open themselves up to you. So I guess in terms of my career today, I took the first job that was offered to me when I graduated, and that was on a communications graduate scheme for a company called Chime Communications, and I think they still run the scheme, which I had absolutely no sort of political affiliation to Lord Bell, Tim Bell, who was Mrs. Thatcher's spin doctor, who still heads Chime Communications and Bell Pottinger. But it was an absolutely incredible sort of starting point, because over the course of a year we spent 3 months working at four different agencies in the group, and it just gave a really good diverse experience. So I worked for a public affairs agency, a public relations agency, strategic communications consultancy, research, and just, if you have an opportunity, and obviously there are graduate schemes out there, anything that can give you a quite diverse experience, if you don't know what you want to do, is a really good opportunity to take. At the end of that sort of year-long graduate programme, I ended up working for a public relations agency, and then transitioned into a strategic communications consultancy. And I was there for about 5 years, and the sort of, worked on some terrible clients, and worked on some really interesting ones, but always felt that actually, working with charities was what actually sort of I felt a commitment to, and ultimately was what I would like to tried to transition into. But I still had no idea of the best way of going about doing that. And about 5 years in, my then boss, said, I'm thinking of setting up my own agency. Do you fancy coming with me? So the two of us set up the PR agency, and that was, amazing experience as well, because I think setting up any kind of new organisation, whether that's business, a charity, a social venture, is, in terms of a learning experience, is one of the steepest learning curves, because, particularly for small new ventures, whether they are in the private sector or the voluntary sector, you literally have to learn to do everything, and that gives you, I think, an incredible broad range of skills, which stands you in good stead for, becoming more marketable to prospective employers further down the line. And for me, we started, two of us setting up a PR agency that, within a couple of years had sort of growing into a top 100 agency. And yeah, over that period of time, I just ended up specialising advising charities, a lot of big international NGOs, Oxfam, Nelson Mandela Foundation, and one of those clients was a small organisation called the Rwandan Survivors Fund, which was set up by a Rwandan woman to support and represent survivors of the genocide in Rwanda. And yeah, I was basically introduced to her, and I think this sort of gives, yeah, for me, a good example of how you can open yourself up to opportunities. Came about through voluntary work that I was doing, working with an organisation called the Holocaust Educational Trust. Jewish myself, you know, had an interest in Holocaust education. Tower Hamlets, where I was living at the time in Bethnal Green, didn't have a Holocaust Memorial Day programme, so a couple of us just went to the council and said, you know, we feel that there should be a Holocaust Memorial Day programme in Tower Hamlets. You know, would you give us a budget to do something? And they agreed to do it, so became involved in organising Holocaust Memorial Day for Tower Hamlets. Through that, you know, did some work with the Holocaust Educational Trust, working with survivors who we brought to our Holocaust education events. Het was doing work with SURF, and knowing that I worked professionally in that world, yeah, an introduction, I was introduced to Mary and the work of SURF, and began representing SURF back in 2004. And after doing that for 3 or 4 years, I had to make a choice whether to stay in business or to try and make a leap from business. And that's what I decided to do, and applied to do a master's in public administration, and was very fortunate to get a fellowship to NYU. I went to New York for 18 months, and did the master's in public administration, did a fellowship in social entrepreneurship. Absolutely incredible experience, and I think from my experience, doing a master's after you've worked for 6 or 7 years enables you to bring a different perspective to the learning that I felt I would never have benefited as much from if I was to have just done it after 1 or 2 years of work or going straight into a master's from an undergraduate degree. Because, you know, you can immerse yourself and utilise the experience that you have accrued, you know, over a course of a number of years to really, I think, get the most out of a programme such as that. It was actually whilst I was in New York, SURF's founder director was retiring. They couldn't find anyone else to do the job, and it was offered to me that I should apply for the position. And yeah, started in post in 2009, and it's been, you know, an incredible journey, because at that point I didn't realise that I wanted to actually work for a charity. I was quite enjoying just working with charities as a consultant, and that was something I just thought I'd continue to do. Working for a small charity in the development field at the time that I took on this post, which was, you know, 2009, where, you know, funding was particularly tight, again, was a brilliant learning experience that, utilising, I think, skills that you've accrued from university, and I've definitely sensed, you know, there are, you know, things that you can involve yourself in. I was involved in RAG, involved in sort of voluntary work at sort of whilst I was at university, that definitely have felt, yeah, you can always apply them to your professional experience. But I think as well, something I've learnt in post, and I'll probably leave SURF next year, you know, having done the job for 5 years, is, you know, again, having no idea what I will move on to do, but again, just opening yourself up to opportunities. And I think speaking to other people in the kind of position that I'm now in, the world of work is a very different place to the one that I joined, just in the space of that sort of 14-year period. You know, the whole work environment has changed, and people's attitudes to work and the kind of work they want to do has changed. You know, I'm very fortunate through technology to be able to, you know, work independently, work from home, work flexible hours. You know, I manage a team of 10 in Kigali, but I'm the only staff member here. You know, that suits my sort of style of working. But it's also, and there's a guy called Cliff Pryor who runs a brilliant organisation called Unlimited, talks about portfolio careers. You know, everyone is the entrepreneur of their own life, and it's not just about doing one thing. More and more, it is a case of doing several things concurrently. And, you know, alongside the work I do at SURF, I've just set up a business, a social enterprise, developing dairy-free as desserts, you know, because I had a couple of Hasidic friends in Stamford Hill that I did PR 4 years ago, who I went around for dinner, served up this incredible dessert, and I said, you know, we should just make a business of it. And, you know, that's something I just do alongside, I guess, the development work, but the skills that I have from managing, you know, a £1 million charity that, you know, you can just bring to managing a social enterprise. And I think that's something that you should really sort of think seriously about is, you know, there's no right or wrong thing to do, particularly if you're not specifically focused on working towards a goal, that, yeah, opportunities will come along, whether that's, you know, I have friends who ask me, you know, after I left university, would you help, you know, serve as a trustee for the theatre company that I'm setting up, which I knew nothing about theatre companies, knew nothing about being a trustee. I said, yeah, it sounds an interesting experience, and yeah, that's been a great learning experience as well. And I think if you're looking to go into development, I guess the two main sort of tips I would have in terms of getting a lot of CVs and applications is, you know, those that have experience of working in developing countries. You know, it sounds obvious, but you know, you get so many CVs and applications of people that say, oh, yeah, I'd love to work in development. So, well, you know, what experience you have of working in a developing country, and there's no experience. And there's, you know, a lot of opportunities to do that. VSO, I know a lot of people who've done voluntary, you know, position with VSO that has led into a professional role, either at VSO or other organisations that they have been exposed to undertaking their work. Or likewise, yeah, looking for opportunities to develop sort of skills, and there are a lot of, I think, sort of new programs that have developed that have become very marketable for those looking to transition into a development job. So, like Teach First, for example, community organizing work. There's a new program called Year Here that I'm aware of. That, you know, it's very difficult to get your first sort of step on the ladder, and particularly, and more so, I think, in development, where actually, yeah, you need to develop and prove that you have experience. And I think, yeah, just working towards developing as much exposure as you can across many different kinds of organisations, develop as many possible skills, will hold you in the best of stead going forward, and finding ultimately what's the best sort of marketable skill that you can have. And working in development, I can say, if you are good at writing a proposal, any development organisation will want you on their team, because ultimately it's about generating funding to be able to undertake the work. And anyone can learn to write good proposals, and, you know, volunteer for organisations to help them write proposals. I think for any charity, that's, you know, really good sort of probably sort of skill that you could be looking to cultivate now.
Thanks very much, David. Some really, really interesting points actually raised there. I think things that I picked up on, this thing about kind of, I guess if we're going to use the horrible career term, but this happenstance, you know, actually not knowing what way your career might change direction is actually a really viable method to go out and start looking for your career. For people who come and see me and say, oh, any of us in the department, you know, I need to find out my plan now for the next 10 years, it's really unlikely, because I think if we take all of our options here, we've all changed. I've changed careers 4 or 5 times since graduating in 2003. We all have had various different kind of options. So I think thinking about some of these things that they've talked about with regard to changing direction, doing master's courses once you're in a career, finding different routes and exploring them. The thing you said about unlimited, really interesting, because we actually, don't know who's aware of this, but we have the Entrepreneurial Masterclass where we actually have unlimited coming to the LSE and running things in conjunction with us about using not just entrepreneurial skills to set up your own business, but then to use it just in your job search, in your career search in general. So thanks very much to all the panellists who have really, really contributed there. I'd really like to open it out to some questions, because I think there's been some really useful things there. Does anybody have anything or would like to start us off with a question for any of the panellists? Yeah, go right ahead.
How did you decide, whenever you changed your career, because you say, well, you didn't have a plan, did people come up to you and say, well, you know, I have this really great idea, we need some people? Would you fancy doing this, or did you feel after some years you actively had to change your move because it didn't feel right anymore. This is one question, and the other question is, was money an issue? Well, because I wonder if you were saying, oh, I just did this class for the full time, it was probably not well paid, so did you just live on a very, very simple budget, or was this no concern to you?
So the theatre work I was just doing on a voluntary sort of capacity, and you know, if you're a trustee for a charity, it's not actually that much work. It depends on the nature of the charity, but it's great experience, and it, you know, shows a commitment to be involved in charitable work as a trustee or even as a school governor. You know that's a great opportunity. You know, any school, if you've got a local school, I bet you they will be looking for new governors. You know, it shows that you're willing to put yourself out there to develop some new skills. I think, in terms of my perspective, and again, probably like Ross, you know, we were entering work in a very different time to today. And, you know, 1999, you know, it was still the internet bubble. You know, communications companies had more money than sense at that particular juncture. But I think, actually, if you want to work in charity, actually, starting in business gives you probably a degree of financial security that is very hard to develop if you go straight into a charitable job, because by nature, charitable jobs, particularly at a more junior level, are just not particularly well paid. So it'll sort of enable you to sort of develop, you know, not quite quickly, but you know, certainly a degree of sort of financial cushion that would be very difficult to do if you went straight into a charitable job. And then in terms of when is the right time to transition, difficult to know. I'm going through that sort of question myself. I've just started another fellowship program, which, you know, again, I just look for learning opportunities. This is called the Core Social Leadership Program that works, you know, with potential or aspiring leaders in the social sector in the UK. You know, and that sort of gives you a bit of space to reflect. And I think, actually, you know, there's no right or wrong time to move from a job. I think, you know, you try work when is a good time for you as well as when is a good time for the organisation. I think at this point, I know I will have done, you know, I'll probably leave SURF after 5 years. I feel, you know, that's long enough to make a good contribution, but it's probably good to leave an organisation on the up and realise, you know, when it is still sort of moving on the up. And I think as well, you just know, I know after doing this job for 4 years, I'm actually, a lot of jobs are quite cyclical, and you realise quite quickly that you're doing the same thing. You know, you're better at doing it, and it's a lot easier at doing it, but you're just learning less, and it's that law of diminishing returns. And I think, yeah, so it's being aware of, you know, when is a job starting to become comfortable. And being comfortable isn't a bad thing, but if you really want to challenge yourself, you know, you really got to sort of think about, actually, that's maybe a sign that you should be thinking of moving, and not being scared to do something different. I think, yeah, there's no right or wrong career path, and I think actually employers probably look now beneficially on those that have got a range of different experiences than necessarily having, you know, a one very sort of clear, defined path. But, you know, actually, in some sectors, it's worthwhile developing that very deep sort of knowledge and experience, whereas in other sectors, particularly if you're working for small organisations, I think, yeah, having a broad base of skills is beneficial.
I think picking up on those points, I agree with a lot of what you're saying. I think coming back to what you mentioned at some point as well about how can you actually afford it? Let's say you finish your undergraduate degree, you need a job because you need to pay back your fees that you've got to pay off. And you're in this really difficult situation where, yes, some employers are offering unpaid work experience, some people, you know, possibly, you know, or very low paid. But how do you achieve that balance? And this is where I think it is different from what it was like when we maybe graduated, or some of us, because I do think it is a lot harder now. And that's why I guess we're trying to push a little bit more onto people whilst at university to say, yeah, absolutely, come out with your really good degree, hopefully, or master's course, but also think about what else you're doing in your spare time, because the time when you're studying now is a bit of time when maybe you can afford more to do a bit of work experience that isn't paid or shadowing or that sort of experience, because you're in the kind of education environment, and then maybe you only need to take a little bit of kind of unpaid work experience, which is very short, or you've built up a range of things that will help an employer see and give you a more paid internship or kind of work experience when you come out. It is difficult, but I think it's that piecemeal kind of approach to trying to find a few different experiences.
Can I say
something? Yeah, of course.
So I did an unpaid internship at the National Trust for 6 months, so that's quite a long time. And the reason I did that was because I was desperate to work for the National Trust, and I thought, this is my way in. If I work for them for 6 months, they're bound to give me a job. Little did I know they were about to go through their restructuring process and make everyone redundant. So that didn't really work out for me. But I think there's two things. One is, if you really want to do something and you think it's worthwhile, you'll find a way to do it. So I worked for the National Trust for 3 days a week. I commuted from my mum's home in Woking to Swindon, which was a 2.5 hour commute one way, so that's like 5 hours a day commute and 3 train journeys. And I worked in Boots 3 days a week, so I was doing 6 days a week work, and that was my paid like bread money. And I worked like 6 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon shift, so it wasn't much fun, but I did it because I thought it was really worthwhile, and I got a great experience out of it. So there are ways to do it. It is difficult. There's sort of no getting around that. The other thing is, as you were saying, trying to do stuff while you're at uni still, it's a really good way of doing it. When I was at LSE, I volunteered for Coin Street Community Builders, who are a charity just across by Waterloo. So I used to help on their steering group for their heritage group. And I did that once a month. So things like that, and being a trustee or a governor, they don't take a lot of time. They're sort of one meeting a month or something like that, and it's a small thing, but it builds up experience the more you do it.
Absolutely agree, and I think if you want to think about voluntary work, that experience, we have a volunteer centre here at LSE for people who aren't aware, so do feel free to come along and see if you can find an opportunity. From a general kind of stance of what do LSE feel about generally unpaid internships, I can say that I think we would say in some sectors up to kind of 3-4 weeks we would deem as work experience. Once it goes beyond that and you're doing more like a 6 month experience for free, we would probably tell you to start now having serious conversations with that employer about whether that is a fair system, and we could talk to you on a one-to-one basis about that, because we're fully for trying to support people getting paid if you're doing actual work within areas that are not charities, who are not voluntary or charity work. But having said that, you've heard all the experience from people on the panel. Anything else? Questions? Yeah, please go ahead.
I have a question for Ms. Early about
I'm quite glad you mentioned internships, because I think they are hugely and disgracefully exploitative, and I think my industry is terrible for it. The one good thing about journalism is if you get something published, you can get paid per article. So I'll just say that first, that at least you are getting money coming in. So you say, my name is in the paper, I know what your rate per word is, find that out from somebody will tell you. And you get paid for it. So that's just my thing. In terms of getting into it, I mean, lots of people obviously go to City and they do, or wherever, Cardiff, and they do their 1 year of journalism, which is incredibly expensive. And I wouldn't have had the money to do that. I had to live at home when I was doing a master's, which was not ideal, when I was doing a master's here. And the thought of I think my parents would have shot me if I'd mentioned another year of studying, and where the hell was I going to get money to do that when I was already quite heavily in debt, obviously, from my first degree. what my attitude to it was I could learn on the job in journalism. And I know that it's so much harder now to get that first thing, but I really think the best thing to do is get your foot in the door and don't let them shut the door however hard they try. So I made the Standard pay for, and they're very generous about this, pay for me to learn shorthand, which I think probably you'll find most learners don't bother with today, but they probably should because it's a useful skill and it looks good. It always impresses people that I can do this odd thing that they think is Arabic, and then they don't know what I'm writing, which is also really useful because I'm probably noting down what they're wearing because I can never remember that when I'm interviewing someone, or an annoying little tick that they have or whatever it is. So from a history background, I don't think it's in any way a problem. I think it's a really good thing actually to come from it from something different. That cliche of a city master's, which admittedly has come from some other degree, I don't know, I don't think that's the best way into journalism. I think it's a waste of a year, personally. They obviously will dispute that, but then it's a hell of a lot of money. And I don't think it's necessary. I think, yeah, it depends which bit of journalism as well. I mean, magazines, which are, again, hugely exploitative, but there are some paid internships that you can get. Elle magazine, for example, pays. Which actually, I mean, it's fashion mag, but it has a very high quality of writing on its features desk. And so there are other places where certainly internships would be paid, perhaps not very well. Certainly at the bottom of journalism, you do not earn very much money. The starting salary is very low, incredibly low, in fact, on local papers, although local papers are dying very quickly. And certainly in the bottom of TV, being a runner, you're not going to earn very much money at all, but you will earn money, which is better than nothing. I don't know, did I answer a question? Okay.
You reminded me when you talked about the shorthand. My brother's a journalist and he went through and learned shorthand, and he had this really annoying tape, Rosamund, I don't know whether you, and he used to play it in our flat, where it's a slowed down woman's voice. You want to kill her by the end. So it was awful, but yeah, you brought me back that horrible memory. Anything else? Yeah, absolutely, at the back then I'll come to you.
Okay, my gut feeling, other people might disagree on this, the best thing you can do is just write and get your name out there. Just write for websites, write for, you know, your local paper or this paper, whatever it is, so you just have a portfolio. The thing about getting specific knowledge, you will not end up writing on that subject. So I have knowledge of population and development. I've probably written 4 pieces in the last 5 years which have involved population and development. That is just the way of it. You can't pick which bit of the industry you're going to end up in and what you're going to end up writing, because I think that is so limiting. And I think one of the reasons I got the job on the business desk, and what's interesting was that they advertised that job in 3 places, the LSE, Cambridge and Oxford careers website. And what I know about the other people who went for the job is that they probably didn't have, well, I know that they didn't have very good portfolios. And the other thing being, people will probably put off applying for that job because they thought, oh shit, business, what do I know about business? Probably not people from here, but from Oxford and Cambridge, certainly. And the truth is, you don't need to know that much when you're starting out. I happen to have an interest in it, and I've read the papers, which was what you needed to have done. What I think surprises me is the number of people who try to go into journalism who don't read a paper, or, you know, the whole way through. It's completely insane every day, which is like the basic thing that you need to do, including sports section, even if you have no interest in sport, because you should know. You know, you need an awareness of what is going on. I don't read them all anymore, but I read everything. I read 5 newspapers a day, and that's like a bad day. Like, I would try to read, you know, 6, 7. You're not reading everything. But yeah, I think the more crucial thing is read papers and write, and have good grammar. God, I mean, the number of people who don't understand basic grammar rules, and it looks really shabby, frankly. Like, if you have clean copy in the industry, and like, there are some really high-profile journalists who don't, and you know, you are sometimes surprised by this, but frankly, if you get the reputation of somebody who is filing copy, which is your raw, what you've written, which, you know the basic grammar rules, and you're not splitting infinitives or saying try and, the number of people will appreciate that. They will know that there's less work to do on your writing. So yeah, that is my sort of what I'm always astounded other people don't get. But yeah.
That's helpful, thank you. Down here, yeah.
For Sophie, is there anything you felt in your application for last year that was particularly that meant you were selected over other people?
Oh, that's really difficult. So the fast stream selection process is a really long one, and I think that the first few stages are quite difficult to kind of stand out, and in a way they're not really looking for people to stand out in the first few stages. It's just kind of ticking the box, yes, you meet the grade. If you end up getting to the assessment centre, I think then you have the chance to really stand out in your application. Things that I had kind of feedback on, which I think they do look for and are important, are you going to be able to be the type of person who can be a civil servant? And what I mean by that is somebody who, I don't want to say is apolitical, because I do hold political views and I do have very strong feelings about certain policies, but I'm naturally somebody who's very objective and can always see the other side of the argument, and I'm quite happy to argue that blue is red even though I personally think that it's red, not blue. So they do look for that kind of behaviour, and one of the questions you do get asked in the interview is, I can't remember the exact phrasing, but it's something along the lines of, would you ever not take a job because you felt strongly against the policy? And if you say, I wouldn't take the job, they're probably going to think, well, you're not the kind of person who's going to want to fill that job. And I think you have to be honest with yourself about that as well, because if you do hold very strong political views and you wouldn't be comfortable supporting that policy, then the civil service is probably not a job for you. So I think that's important. And I think the other thing is really about, I suppose it's a lot around skills. The great thing about the civil service recruitment process is they look for potential, they're looking for competencies, they're looking to see that you have the potential to be able to show certain behaviours. So it's not so much like a classic job interview where you're showing you've got certain experience. It's much more about showing that you have that skill set. So it's focusing on, I mean, it's great to have the experience and to have kind of examples that you can show that you showed that behaviour, and if it's, you know, that you worked in some really high profile legal case, then obviously that's impressive, but it's more about showing that you have the skill set. And if that's working in the LSE Drama Society, yes, I did use that example, that's great as well.
Anything else? Any other questions? Oh, yeah, I'll go here and then.
Yeah, Mr. Grossman, you mentioned that you have a master's degree in something that's not really relevant for journalists.
Yeah.
How do you kind of sell it into your employer?
I pretend that development was 100% about economics. That's what I did when I went for my interview. I can remember they actually asked me, so do you actually have an interest in business? And I said, well, I've got a PPE degree, so a third of my degree was economics. I actually dropped economics after the first year. there's probably public knowledge now anyway. And I pretended that all of that master's was quite heavily in economics. I'm sure he knew I was slightly bullshitting. But you've got to obviously prove that you... I suppose you've got to make use of what you have, haven't you? I mean, it has a heavy economics component anyway. I guess, like, there's no degree that is that relevant for journalism. I mean, anyone who does media studies is completely mad, frankly. It's not going to get you a job in journalism. It's, you know, it's far too competitive for that. I'm sure there is a great media studies degree out in another sort of that. But, you know, that's not really what they're looking for. They're looking for intellectual... They're looking for two things. The really useful thing about PPE, and this would be true of history too, politics for me was great because you read this huge amount of information and you had to squish it down to something short. And that is a really, really useful skill for journalism, because that's what I'm doing, you know, every day. And philosophy was really, really helpful because you're doing something that is so complicated, and a lot of business stories actually have something really complicated, and you're trying to make it understandable and simple. I had to make it understandable because otherwise I wouldn't have understood it, frankly. And if you're going to regurgitate it in an exam, you've bloody got to understand it. So I think there's always skills that are so much more helpful. And being careful about words as well, which comes into history, probably not quite as much as philosophy, but careful about the exact meanings of words. Because there's a really important thing about the way you express yourself. There's this thing that really, really annoys me, which is that 99% of journalists don't know what the word coruscating means. It does not mean biting, which is like a biting insult, which is what everyone uses it as. It means shiny. And it's this really annoying thing, because for me, we have a duty as journalists to get language correct, because what the hell else are we doing this job for, frankly? Because what you're trying to do is help people understand things, and you're actually making the world murkier, as I always think of it. So I guess the most useful thing is to learn that your words are really, really important. And that makes it sound really pretentious. It's not. I mean that in a really simple way. Also read George Orwell's Rules on Writing. Everybody should read those. Because his best advice is don't use a long word when you can use a short one. And there is so much, I mean, obviously there's some journalists who do this beautifully, but there is so much that is self-indulgent about writing. And we all do it a little bit. We overwrite, particularly if we're writing at speed. That's the other useful thing about history, right? You've written really long essays in exams that will be written really fast. Well, sometimes you have 15 minutes to bang out a story that's, you know, 140 words, 160 words, sometimes longer. I wasn't a particularly deadline-y even when I was doing business, because I usually knew what I was writing that day. But that is a real knack, to be able to do that really, really fast and get it right. There's one other thing I'd say, by the way, on the civil service. I got rejected from Fast Stream, which clearly shows that process works, because the idea of me being objective, and my job is, you know, to have an opinion on something. I mean, yeah, their screening process works. So you don't try to bullshit them. I read a book about how to be a good civil servant. I was really desperate. That was my year when I was doing that dreadful slave spreadsheets job. And I read a book about how to be a good civil servant. I was so desperate. And got through the first stage, and then there's a test where they test if you're actually a good civil servant. And you think like a civil servant, and they see through you. So, yeah.
That's really interesting. And I think taking what you said and using it from a careers point, which I would like to put out to everybody, is one thing that we do a lot of. It's a lot more about practical advice that we give these days rather than like trying to foresee into the future and guess what people's jobs are going to be. But we do a lot around CV writing, cover letters, different applications to various different sectors. And that's simple. Simple words and being simple with your language, and whether it's professional with your language or whatever, instead of using, you know, extremely this, and just keep it simple, because the amount of times I see people tripping up in cover letters because they're trying to make their language sound more exciting is amazing, actually. And it usually just ends up confusing people, especially if English is not your first language, it can really trip you up, so do be careful on that front.
Can I add something about journalism CVs? Sorry to keep writing on. But there is something that really drives me nuts, which is that obviously we all get sent CVs. God knows why they're sending it to me, as if I have any power over who comes in to do work experience. But I get sent a load of them. And my God, if you're going to apply for journalism, one, learn to spell, or at least learn to spell check. But more importantly, don't use phrases that are the kind of thing that sounds really like it's come out of Babelfish language translator. I mean, I'm really completely astounded that if you want to write for a living, people would send CVs that have really actually just piss poor English in it. The kind of English that sounds like you're trying to be somebody else, so you're saying these phrases that management speak or whatever. Mm. You know, I'm a really good team player. I mean, what the hell does that even, you know, I think that's terrible. Journalism has its own sort of hideous vocabulary, which is known as journalese. And again, should be avoided. It's a sort of different kind of hideous English, but sloppy phrases that you'll see a lot in newspapers, and frankly, they're just as bad, and they shouldn't be anywhere near a CV either.
Thank you. Alexandra, sorry, just wanted to ask you, you've probably gone through the process you know, most recently out of everyone on this panel. And it would be really helpful probably for some people in this room just to think about why you think you got through, what you found particularly challenging throughout the process, whether it was the application form itself through to the assessment process, that sort of exercise, just for people in the room. So have you got any comments on that?
What I would say is that it's a very competitive industry, and I discovered that very quickly. And I really found that preparation was the key. You have to know the firm that you're applying to. You have to know them more than just on a surface level as well. So do your research, not just online, not just their website, but actually the papers. It's very important to make sure that you're reading the paper, to make sure that you know what's going on in the world. Because ultimately, what's going on in the world will affect your clients. And what the papers are writing about may well be your clients. So you have to make sure that you're aware of the world as a whole, you're aware of the firm, you're aware of the sector, what's going on in that sector, is anything going on? So, you know, the lawyer, that kind of thing, the legal journalism side of it. And you have to make sure that when you go to assessment centres, when you go to meet recruiters, you are prepared. I can't stress that enough. If you turn up to a recruiter at an event, whether it's a law firm or anything like this, and you say, so what does your firm do? It's not the best thing in the world. It's better to sort of go knowing what they do, what they specialise in, if they specialise in anything. Do they have firms all over the world? Do they just have a firm in London? And all that sort of thing. And it's the same thing for the whole process, just to make sure that you're prepared the whole way through, that you've done your homework, that you do the work, put the legwork in, and it will pay off eventually.
And that's really helpful. I think a little bit of legwork for, like, even a fair, you kind of think, oh, I can just come along and kind of see, but you'll very soon feel, when you go to, let's say, the law fair that we have here at LSE Careers, that you suddenly feel a little bit out of your place when you don't know anything about some of the law firms around you. So I would say, if you do want help on that, you can come and speak to us. We can help point you in the right direction before those events. And I think it reminds me of a point when I was in one of my previous guises, which was working for an investment bank as a graduate recruiter into trading. Oh, I should say that quite quietly, but I did that when I first left university. And I remember being at a careers fair and somebody coming up to me, one of the students, and saying, so it was the investment banking side of a big bank that we know today, and saying, is it possible to open a bank account with you? And meeting around to them and going, no, I think you want the freshers fair, guys. You've got the wrong idea out of this. So I think just having that idea is quite important. Any more questions? Sorry, yes, one back at the back.
Yeah, this is another one to do with the objective in the civil service.
Okay.
Say if you're interested in policy making, but also hold certain opinions, is it better to maybe apply for a department that you have less of an opinion about?
That's really difficult, because the way in which the fast stream works is, if you're lucky enough to get through the process, you can have some say in where you get placed, but you can't, like, say, oh, I want to work there, because there's only a certain number of places, so you could end up being placed anywhere. I mean, maybe if you feel very strongly about it, it would be worth it, but I think you probably should question whether it's the right kind of job for you, if you really feel strongly that you couldn't kind of
make policy. Yeah, but maybe when you're picking your preferences, I don't know, putting something like Department of Pensions before Education, if you have a strong view of Education.
Yeah, I mean, you could just put Education right at the bottom and hope that it never filtered down that far. But there would be the other thing is that you know, you might feel very strongly about education, but do you feel very strongly about every educational policy? There might be some parts of, I mean, the Department for Education is a huge department. I'm sure that you wouldn't really hate every policy that they have, I'd hope. I think it is quite unusual to end up on the one policy area that you really have an issue with.
Kind of maybe links in, though, with a little bit what Rosamund was saying about you might not end up go at writing about the things you want to write about or do things, but you probably, once you start into them, and I'm going back to what David said, once you start into something, you realise actually it involves this, this and this that I didn't quite realise at the beginning, and that's an I can find interesting elements of this to get involved in.
I mean, the reason I wanted to work in DCMS was that it has one of its arms length bodies, it's English Heritage, and it does all the heritage policy. So I thought, great, that's me in, I'm back in the heritage sector. Got in and found that I'd been placed in gambling, which was like the one part of DCMS I thought, I'm never going to want to work there, and actually it's the best role I've had so far. I absolutely loved it. So I think there's a lot of ways to get to somewhere in your career that you want to be, and it's not always the most direct route, and B, you quite often realise that that might not be the place that you want to end up once you've started down the kind of wiggly road.
Sorry, just on another point, just having listened to all of that, and as a recruiter at the moment sort of screening applications, I just want to pick up on a few things that I actually completely agree with. Especially when I've done the law fairs this season, it's surprising how many people come up to you and say, what do you do? And when you've got that one-to-one time with a recruiter or someone at that firm, you want to be, you know, showcasing yourself as someone who's clearly researched, knows exactly why they're interested in the firm, and have some good, solid questions. So, you know, what type of work do you do in this office is an area I'm interested in, because, you know, you might have been travelling out there or have connections out there, things like that, that's going to separate you. Because at the moment, we've had so many applications of people, you know, that have solid academics, they have A's, they have strong 2-1s and on course of those things, that actually things that are going to set you apart is your knowledge, you know, your business knowledge, having researched the firm in a lot more depth than logging onto the website and reading the paper for the last week. It really is coming through on applications how people haven't researched outside of naming the offices and the number and the work that you do. It's about having a bit more knowledge. So things like this are great to go to and kind of get an understanding of what firms are actually looking for, because an academic, you know, having that solid academic is a standard now, and you're in a market where a lot of people have that. So in terms of getting that unpaid work experience, I agree, not for long periods of time. And the firm I work for, Clyde & Co, actually do formal vacation schemes that you're paid on for 2 weeks. But anything you can get to really sell yourself outside of your academics is fundamentally important at the moment.
Yeah, I think really, again, reiterate really good points. And I think I in my role, I get to see a lot going into different sectors and from very intelligent people. Most people at LSE, you know, have a good level of intelligence, and yet there are people who are able to sell their experience more, even if that is a few, you know, whether it's the drama club, whether it's working for the Economic Society, whether it's doing some volunteering, and are able to put that down on a CV, an application form, or sell it in some way. And others who find that a little bit more difficult. So if you are struggling, do come and see one of us, because we would be happy to review that and have a look and help you to try and tease it out of you. Because a lot of people say to me, I've not got anything relevant. And then you hear that actually they've done part-time work all the way through school that they think is irrelevant because, oh, it's not really related to the sector. Well, no, it possibly isn't. It probably isn't related to the sector that you want to go into. But there are skills that you can pull out of that and really try and talk about. And at this stage in your career, you're going to have to, because what else do you have to go on? You've got your academics. You've got some work experience that maybe you've done as part of your time here. And some of you may have a little bit more experience, but you need to find ways to be able to demonstrate skills through what little you maybe have, so we can help you do that if you're struggling to do that. Any final questions? We've got kind of the last 5 minutes now, so has anyone got anything that they want to kind of finish off with? Well, I'm going to ask a final question then, if nobody does, because I think what would be really helpful, having heard what everybody said here today, and there's lots of themes that have come out, but if I could take it to each of you and really say, okay, flip it back. You are sitting over there in that part of the audience wanting to get into your sector or your area. And I know it's like, this is always puts a lot of pressure on people, but what is it that you would say are the major things that they need to be doing? It doesn't have to be one bit of advice, but two or three things for them to take away and maybe go and work on or think about when they leave here today. who can I start with? Anyone to convince?
Yeah, that's that. I mean, yeah, I think if you want to get into development, go to a developing country. And if you want to get good experience and do that cheaply, there's an easy way to do if you go live in many developing countries. The cost of living is little or nothing, and you can actually get away with earning very little money. It's just a great opportunity to immerse yourself. You know, you don't even have to go there. I know a lot of people who have done that, who've actually, you know, not having sort of got sorted, you know, the internship or the experience that they wanted to do, just go out there. You know, you'll see organisations, you know, working literally on the street, and, you know, approach them. And I think that's, you know, just the best experience is just is getting some experience, and I think that just becomes, you know, very valuable if prospective employers. And I think, yeah, most people that I know that have got into development at a junior level, which is much harder to do, have done so through that path by getting the experience themselves, rather than sort of applying to DFID, although DFID is recruiting a lot at the moment. Yeah, even still at the junior post, they want to see some experience. So I think that's most important.
Thank you.
I'm going to defer to Dorothy Parker and say something very negative and then say something positive at the end. Dorothy Parker, who is probably the wittiest woman who's ever lived, said, if you have any young friends who aspire to become writers, the second greatest favour you can do them is to present them with copies of The Elements of Style. George Orwell's Rules on Writing, it's pretty much the same thing. The first greatest, of course, is to shoot them now while they're happy. Anyway, on a more positive note, write and read, and it's as simple as that. This is actually, everybody makes out that journalism is the single hardest thing you can ever get into, and it will always be an element of luck, and it is bloody hard, and particularly now. And bear in mind, and this always makes me laugh, George Osborne failed to become a journalist. But look at the newspapers and see some of the people that they do take in this industry. Alcoholics, plagiarists, people who've been done for perjury, and children. And you realise it is doable if you are bloody stubborn enough. So be incredibly stubborn. Once that door is open, don't let it shut. Don't be annoying to other journalists, because word gets around quite quickly. And so don't sort of harangue people because, you know, there's nothing more annoying than somebody who's desperate to... nobody seems to realise that I don't commission anything. I'm a writer. You know, you need to be asking editors. But just write and read. And read very witty people. Or read people you think are really, really good, and think about why they are good writers. And, you know, George Orwell actually is massively overquoted by journalists, but he is a phenomenal journalist. And his essays, if you go back and you've got him writing about things like